Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Concurrent Session 2A. I'm going to be your chairperson today. My name is Chow Chow. Before we start, I'd just like to remind you that there is a website for this seminar. It is www.actuaries.asn.au/ISS2015. And on the microsite, you'll be able to find a presented feedback survey and also the general feedback form. We would appreciate your feedback to make our conference better in the future. Also, I would like to remind you that when you speak, please speak to a microphone, because all of our sessions are recorded, and if you don't speak to a microphone, your questions won't be recorded. Without further ado, I would like to introduce our presenter today, Hugh Miller. Now, Hugh is an actuary at Taylor Fry, where he has been a consultant for the past 9 years. Over that time, he has been involved in a number of injury scheme projects, including valuation, statistical case estimates, and impact measurement of legislative changes. He also does a significant amount of work in social services, where he has helped pioneer approaches that measure the long-term cost to governments and the subsequent impact of reform. In particular, he has been the technical head of the annual New Zealand welfare valuation over the past 5 years. He has also strong research interests and completed a PhD in statistics in 2009, focusing on techniques that handle modern data sets that have many variables. Please welcome Hugh Miller.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. So I will be talking, does this work? About welfare. So Taylor Fry has had the privilege of being involved in some work with the New Zealand welfare system. So that's been running for a number of years now. So it's quite interesting work, and Alan Greenfield, who's led the work at Taylor Fry, has graciously given me the opportunity to flounder about talking about it. So as Chow mentioned, I'm technical lead, so that means that giving a very non-technical talk, which is what I'm doing today, puts me at risk of sounding silly, so please be forgiving. The other thing I wanted to do before I start is point out that lots and lots of people have been involved in this work, and I wanted to thank the people who are at the conference, so at least I don't get in trouble immediately. So Greg Taylor is here, and he was involved in some of the technical development at the start. Ben McBride from New Zealand Treasury is also here, so he played a key role in getting this all off the ground. And, of course, Alan will be awarded his Actuary of the Year award tonight, I believe, and as part of that, related to the work he's done with this. All right. So, as I mentioned, the New Zealand government have been exploring a new approach to the welfare system. And this has happened over a number of years, and there's been a few key emphases as part of that. So one is that they've tried to be more customer-focused, so focus on the individual and their outcomes. A second is they want to take a longer-term view. And so that need for a longer-term view has been one of the reasons why actuaries have started to become involved, and indeed there is now a number of welfare actuaries working in the New Zealand Ministry of Social Development, which manages the welfare system. So this talk describes what's gone on. It has a particular focus on the valuations, which is the part of the services that Taylor Fry provides, and it's also going to sort of take some reference to injury schemes and sort of what potential implications are, given the nature of this conference. So I'm going to start by sort of describing what a welfare system is. And so there's actually a long proper answer to what a welfare system is, and I'm not going to give that long proper answer. Instead, I'm going to sort of give you a few characteristics which I think are interesting. So firstly, it's a series of fortnightly payments to support the cost of living. So those payment levels will depend on various conditions and level of need. There is significant variation in outcomes. So some people go onto the welfare system for a short time and have relatively low need, and some people remain on for many years. And there's a range of outcomes that vary in accordance with that too. And thirdly, the most common form of exit is usually someone finding employment. So that's typically what you see with a welfare system. And the main observation that you see with those points then is that there are some very fundamental parallels between a welfare system and an injury scheme. And so there's actually sort of a lot of overlap in terms of how you can think about them. That overlap's clearly not complete, so there are different issues. But I think there are enough parallels that the actuarial skill set adds a little bit of value. So given that overlap then, how is a welfare system traditionally managed? So here's a traditional welfare system aggregate plot. So this comes from the 2012 New Zealand government budget forward estimates, and this is sort of a very typical sort of aggregate view. So you look at what you were paying over the past few years, and then you make a projection about what those payments are likely to do over the subsequent years. And so I've put two benefit types there. One is the supported living payment, which is sort of the equivalent of the disability support, and the work-ready job seeker payment, which is sort of the equivalent of the unemployment benefit. So this is sort of a useful way to think about it if you're trying to find numbers to put into your budget forecasts, and typically budget forecasts are sort of 4 years' duration. So that's a very natural thing to do. And knowing the aggregate level of cost is obviously of some importance and relevance. However, there are some limitations with that sort of approach, as you can imagine. So the emphasis here is on the stock and not the flow, so you ignore characteristics like how long people are staying on those benefits. So we know that for someone on the supported living payment, in 4 years' time, they have a 75% chance of still being there. So 75% of that cohort will still be on the same benefit. Compare that to the work-ready job seeker, where only 20% of them will. So despite sort of similar-ish looking graphs, they actually have very, very different behaviours underlying. Other limitations is one that you can't sort of immediately see some of the policy changes and their implications. You also tended to see that supplementary benefits like the accommodation support treated as a separate payment type, and that doesn't really recognise the fact that these things all sort of fit together. And so if you receive a main benefit, you're more likely, obviously, to receive a supplementary benefit as well. And finally, the movements between benefit types were not particularly well understood. And by that I mean a very large proportion of someone's future welfare receipt of someone who's unemployed is actually not the unemployment benefit. They are actually very likely to move into other benefit types, be that sickness or sole parent or something else. And so all that basically means is that this sort of view doesn't give you a good customer-centred view or client-centred view, and it doesn't really give you that long-term view as well, sort of a long longitudinal view. Now, I've been deliberately unfair, so, I mean, people who work in welfare understand all these things intuitively, and that's been well known for many years. And so by sort of putting up that graph and pretending that this is what the New Zealand government was doing before, the investment approach is definitely unfair, but it's sort of the straw man that I'm going to start with. So around 2010, New Zealand started a series of reform measures, and one of the first things they did is they appointed a body, the Welfare Working Group, to think about long-term welfare and what recommendations they might make about sort of improving the welfare system. So one of the key observations they made is that there were long-term negative outcomes associated with people being on the welfare system for a long time. And so that's encapsulated in that quote there. And they judge that to be unfair and inequitable because there's an inequality of outcomes and opportunity. So a number of recommendations came out of that. One of those was an upfront investment approach, and so I've used the term investment approach a couple of times. And the idea of that is that if you can see if you make an investment in a person, be that education or something else, in the short term, then you may well see a dividend in the long term in terms of better outcomes for them and possibly even lower welfare receipt as a result. So that's sort of the intuition of the investment approach. And part of that was a recommendation that they adopt annual injury-style valuation, so an annual actuarial valuation, to look at what the long-term cost of welfare is. And related to that again is that this is sort of used as an accountability measure, as sort of a signal of progress over time. And so a lot of the inspiration for all of this is for what goes on in injury schemes, right? So this is exactly sort of how a lot of injury schemes work. So they have an annual valuation, and they try and think about how that long-term cost goes. And so this program of reform was taken up with gusto, I should say, by the New Zealand government, and so that was led by the Ministry of Social Development as well as New Zealand Treasury. And it had a lot of buy-in from the politicians as well, which helped. So lots of inspiration from injury schemes. And I think part of that is that There's a lot of positive energy that I've seen, at least, in injury schemes over the past few years, where people have sort of come to the realisation that you can actually have very, very much win-win scenarios. So if you can improve employment outcomes, for instance, then you have a lower cost of the welfare system to government, and you also have, generally speaking, happier and richer people, tends to correlate well with people finding jobs and finding employment. And so that's, I think, the driving motivation behind that, and I think to this point it appears to have been relatively successful. So you can't have a reform without a framework. And so this is the framework that's kind of been a useful paradigm for thinking about welfare system reform. And so there are three layers, and this is sort of a picture that was developed between the Ministry of Social Development and Alan as part of the feasibility process. So at the top, there's a level one process where you sort of look at the aggregate long-term cost of the welfare system. They were particularly interested in working-age benefits, so how much are you expected to pay to people until they turn 65 in terms of welfare payments? And that aggregate level valuation should be sensitive to various things, so the macroeconomic trends, policy changes, as well as trends in experience. So that's sort of the top level, sort of, I guess, standard valuation is how I think of that. Level two is a focus on segment level outcomes, so organise customers into key reporting segments, and sort of think about what their outcomes are, what their pathways are, and trying to understand that, and then you can sort of think about interventions and funding appropriately. And so one of the things MSD has done relatively recently is they've sort of rejigged their funding regime so that they are very segment-focused and sort of quite formal in how they think about that. And level three is sort of the lower-level tactical stuff, so where you can run fun experiments and see if specific employment programs work better than others, etc. So that's sort of a lot more fun in the sense that you can run little trials and experiments and see what works, what doesn't. And learnings from that can then sort of feed up the chain, and similarly learnings from the top sort of feed down into what experiments might be worthwhile and interesting. So typically, the top two are handled by an annual valuation, so that's what we've been doing for the past few years, and the bottom level is managed by the internal team at MSD, and they have some good insights and actuarial people there. So this has been a useful framework. I think it's probably a useful framework for injury schemes as well, to think about sort of what's happening at the macro level, at a segment level, and at an individual level, or sort of small cohort. So because this wasn't a statutory valuation, there was no obligation to value the welfare system, it had very specific motivations and purposes. And because of that, we were able to design a methodology which was reasonably special, I think, to reflect that. And so we tried to get something that really did give more power to the users, so to the New Zealand government. And so I'll point out a few features to the methodology that we've used. It's individual-based rather than payment type, so we really do attach a lifetime liability to individuals in the welfare system. And we do that by projecting their pathway through the welfare system. That projection is reasonably sophisticated, which is not the same thing as expensive, but it really does allow for different predictive factors. So we have about 20 factors in the model that's grown over time as we've sort of modified and improved it. But it allows for things like gender and age and ethnicity and region and all sorts of things that affect how people typically progress through the welfare system. And it also explicitly allows for macroeconomic variables. So we're able to, I guess, disentangle changes in the valuation due to economic factors via the unemployment rate as a proxy and experience items, which we generally attribute to sort of policy and operational changes undertaken by the government. So it actually provides quite a nice integrated model in that sense. So what's the point of all this? And I guess the point is that the valuation itself provides quite a lot of information. And so I'm going to talk through these things, hopefully relatively quickly. So I'm going to get carried away. This is sort of, I'll start talking more and more about welfare now, but I guess it's worth keeping in mind that there are lots of parallels between what I'll talk about in welfare and the types of things people worry about in injury schemes as well. So you'll also learn that I really, really love charts. So this is sort of lots and lots of charts. So the first thing that you get from the valuation is top-line attribution. So you can see at the right-hand side of that chart the 2014 lifetime cost of the welfare system, so people up to age 65, was $69 billion. And so that's sort of all the people who are in the welfare system or have recently exited, and that we project their welfare payments until they turn 65. So $69 billion is a big number, even when you remind yourself it's New Zealand dollars. So that sort of represents about 30% of New Zealand GDP. So given their national debt is about 40% of GDP, it's a not insubstantial number, and the New Zealand government has elected not to add that to their official balance sheet liability for obvious reasons. So the other thing you can get is that that liability used to be, in 2013, $76.5 billion, and we've got various things that have driven that change. So the first change there is a $2.6 billion decrease due to economic factors. And so that's the easy stuff, such as inflation and discount rates, as well as the hard stuff, so what the macroeconomic assumptions have done and what the actual experience has been for those assumptions compared to what we expected. The second $2.2 billion is the expected roll forward. So generally speaking, if the unemployment rate is expected to go down, and it does go down, then you expect the liability to decrease over time, and that in fact is what happened. And the final item there, the second $2.2 billion in blue, is sort of the change attributable to experience. So that's the numbers of people who left the welfare system who weren't expected to, as well as changes in how long people were tending to stay on the welfare system. And so that's the real sort of key number that we tend to worry about, because that's the bit that is sort of viewed to be within MSD's operational and policy control. So that's the top-line attribution. And I'll also point out that the colours in that chart represent the different benefit types that people are currently receiving, with the yellow line being people who have recently received benefits or who are receiving supplementary only. And I will point out the youth line there is a very, very small purple sliver. So they look very small here, but they are important, and I'll return to that later. So the second thing the valuation provides is the ability to drill down into those results. So that $2.2 billion of experience, improvements due to experience that I mentioned, that is actually calculated at an individual level. And we can do that because we've calculated liability at an individual level. And because of that, we can actually then subdivide and sort of tabulate that any way we want. So here I've done that by people's benefit state, or their segment actually more formally, as at 2013. And we sort of just watched how their liability for those different segments have changed over the year. So if you add those numbers up, they represent that $2.2 billion reduction. And you can see sort of exactly where these things are concentrated. So here, there are big reductions in the sole parent segments. And so that is unsurprising if you know the New Zealand welfare system. So there are some policy changes related to that in terms of part-time work obligations for people with youngest children aged 5 and above. And there were also some changes with how they were case managed, so they were more actively sort of helped into the job market compared to what they were before. Interesting, though, you'll notice that the reduction is not just reserved to the 5 to 13, so the two rightmost bars there. You can see them, the two leftmost bars, and so that's recognising the fact that these people, although they're not transitioning out of the welfare system faster at the moment necessarily, but once their children do age, we expect them to transition out once they sort of receive that case management and are affected by those policy changes. So it is actually sort of, I guess, dynamically responding to how the lifetime liability patterns is evolving. What else is there? So you'll see the green bars in the middle are the supported living clients. So these are people on disability and carers benefit. Those numbers have changed very little over the past year, and that is despite that category sort of being the biggest component of liability in terms of sort of raw dollars. And so that's sort of interesting. It's basically saying that it's business as usual there, not a lot happening. The most exciting bars from my point of view are the yellow bars towards the right. So these are people who have recently exited the welfare system or are supplementary only. And these people have tended to re-enter the welfare system a lot more slowly than historically we would have expected. And so that seems to be a pleasing trend in terms of reducing welfare dependency. So that's attribution. I also mentioned we can look at impacts of legislative changes. So I regret including these charts because they're fun, but they're a little bit complex. So we have three panels. Each of those panels represents a cohort of people, so a 2011 cohort, 2012, 2013, and how they've moved throughout the welfare system over the subsequent four quarters. And so here we're looking at people who are on the sole parent support with a youngest child over 14 years old, and they were subject to two rounds of legislative reform, one in October 2012 and one in July 13. And you can see that the rates at which they're exiting the welfare system and moving to different benefit types has actually changed quite dramatically over that time. So in the 2011 cohort on the left, you'll see that about 17% of them, I think, had exited the welfare system or moved to supplementary benefits after four quarters. And on the right-hand side, that figure's gone up to 25%. And they don't remain as constant as they once did within benefit types, those who do remain. So we sort of measure that, and we also measure the impact of program changes as well. So one of the big-ticket items that the government announced as part of welfare reforms was a youth service, and so this is where they explicitly try and help young people at risk of long-term unemployment or welfare receipt into various objectives. So they're given a mentor effectively and are given sort of very clear objectives in terms of educational outcomes and other things as well. So we can see that as the program was rolled out and the youth service became fully operational, that it really was quite effective in improving exits from the welfare system. So what the chart on the left represents, these are 17-year-olds who are in the welfare system receiving the youth payment or previously it was the IYB. And so at the beginning, so on the left-hand side of that chart, the yellow bar represents how many of them had exited the welfare system after 2 years. And so that used to be about 30%. And since the full youth service has been rolled out, that figure's gone up to about 50%. And there's been similarly sort of proportional increases in the number of people leaving the benefit system among young parents. Of course, the raw numbers itself are lower because young parents do tend to stay on the welfare system longer on the sole parent support. But there's been a very, very pleasing trend, I think, as a result of that full youth service rollout. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was better understanding of the cost drivers. So this chart here basically shows what our expected lifetime value of an individual is for all those clients who are aged 18 to 24. So there's about 100,000 of these people in the welfare system, and you can see that their individual liabilities actually range from very small, so close to zero, to very large, so sort of up to 400,000. On that chart. The colours represent the different benefit types they're on today, and you can see that seems to be highly predictive of how much they'll cost in the long term. And there's a few interesting things. So one is that the average there is 120,000. So that's a big number. That's a discounted number. And that gives you a little bit of insight into what the investment approach is all about. So if you had $120,000 to spend on a person, would you necessarily do that via a lifetime of welfare payments, or would you spend more upfront to hopefully improve their outcomes? And so a lot of the motivation comes from sort of looking at those individual lifetime costs. Moreover, you can see that there's quite a wide spread. So there's a whole lot of people on the left-hand side of that chart whose lifetime welfare cost is relatively small, so a lot lower than the mean. And the people who have been in the welfare system and have recently exited, which are the non-beneficiary yellow section there, do have quite low liabilities. On the converse side, you have about 10% of this population with an expected lifetime cost of over $250,000. And that's a big number, even if it's New Zealand dollars. So in terms of understanding how that spread comes about, we do have a number of different cost drivers in the model. So these are the various different predictors that we use. And we actually sort of can measure how important they are in predicting long-term costs. And so that's what we've done on this chart here. So as the previous chart suggested, current benefit type is hugely predictive. So young parents, sole parent recipients, as well as supported living recipients do tend to stay on the welfare system a long time, and that's completely understandable and good in some ways. However, there are a lot of other factors that are quite predictive as well. So we see that age of entry is very important. So people who enter the welfare system before age 19, for instance, have very, very different outcomes compared to those who enter later. And you can compare the lifetime welfare costs of say, two people who are age 30 and sort of with different age of entries, and you see dramatic differences in their subsequent pathway through. There's a lot of other things there. One thing that we added to the 2014 evaluation was intergenerational information, so that's the fourth most important item there. So this is whether during a client's teenage years, whether their parents were heavily in receipt of welfare benefits, and it turns out that that in itself is highly predictive. And that sort of seems to have led a push towards sort of recognising the early intervention side of all of this. So lots of other things. So we allow for gender, a number of quarters in various benefit types, as well as sort of durations and education level, as well as regional factors. And they all come through as predictive, but not all the same, obviously. This is probably my favourite chart from the 2014 report. I love charts, so it's a big call. We observed that there was a $20,000 difference between the average lifetime liability of someone who lived in the Auckland region and somebody who lived in the Northland region, so the Northland immediately to the north of Auckland there. And so there's a sort of an obvious question then is what's driving that difference in liability? Is it genuinely regional factors so that the management team in Northland is incompetent compared to Auckland and so that's why outcomes are poor there, or is it due to other factors? And so we were able to unpick that, and we did that in the last valuation report. And for that particular example, what we see is that there are different factors driving the difference. So, in fact, all other things being equal, two identical people in Auckland and Northland, you expect a slightly lower liability for that person in Northland. So that's the region, lighter blue, sort of in the middle there. So what you do see then, when you think about the differences between the two regions, is different compositions in the beneficiaries there. So there are more longer-term benefit type recipients in Northland, so more people on sole parent support, supported living. There are also more people who have an extended benefit history in the welfare system, so people who have been in the system a while already, and we know that's a risk factor for continued receipt. And finally, they have a high proportion of Maoris in the population, and that's something that tends to be associated as well with poorer outcomes in terms of long-term welfare receipt. So that was quite interesting and illuminating. So finally, the evaluation provides some evidence and basis for future intervention. So this is sort of one of the more popular charts from the evaluation. I think we've included it every year as a result. Here we've taken the $69 billion of welfare liability and we've split it out by age at the valuation date. So you can see for 22-year-olds in the welfare system, there's about $2 billion of liability attributable to them over the course of their working age lives. However, we've also then subdivided it by what age people enter the welfare system. And so you can see there that the blue lines represent people who have entered before age 20, and the greyer lines are people who entered after age 20. And you see that 75% of the long-term cost of social welfare in New Zealand is attributable to people who entered the welfare system before age 20. And that's pretty remarkable given that less than 5% of the current caseload are below age 20. So it is sort of quite dramatic how that early entry into the wage welfare system can impact that. And one of the motivations clearly for the youth service and in intervening early. So that's a little bit of a description of the valuation and some of the insights it generates. So it's worth saying that the valuation is clearly not everything, and there are lots of things probably more important than the valuation as part of this program of welfare reform. I apologise for putting a sandwich up so close to lunch, but here are some of the other elements that I think are important. So one is stakeholder buy-in. So there have been a lot of government departments, a lot of politicians, and a lot of external stakeholders that have been involved in this process, and I think the fact that so many people have supported it has helped its success, or at least its current success. So Another thing that's very, very important is the fact that the government announced and implemented a series of interventions and changes. So if there was nothing interesting to measure, then having an annual valuation to measure change becomes a lot less relevant and a lot less important. And so the fact that there has been a lot going on is credit to the government and sort of makes the valuation, I guess, more worthwhile. We're very blessed that MSD have very, very good data. So they have a very good data team that sort of has managed that over a number of years. And for various reasons, I think they've also been slow to adopt IT changes, which has been to our advantage as well, because it means you get a nice continuous stream. The modelling has facilitated all of that, and I've talked a little bit about that. And finally is the communication. So, I mean, the New Zealand government have a nasty habit of trying to release things publicly rather than keep it secret, and so all our valuation reports in particular are public. And so one of the things that you then have to learn is how to communicate ideas and make sure that they're well presented and well explained. And to the extent that they can be explained in a chart, all the better from my perspective. So that's pretty much it. So a couple of comments about what next. I think to this extent, the investment approach seems to have been a success, and I guess I put that into two dimensions. So one is the political success, and it seems to have broadened the horizons of the investment approach, both in New Zealand and internationally. So you see trends in what they call impact investing, so sort of putting money up front to try and improve outcomes and measuring that carefully. But you can also see potential applications to other sectors and other countries as well. There's also been some technical success there as well. So it's a valuation approach which is not entirely traditional. And I think that's sort of broadened the horizons a little bit for what's possible. So there are some social sector outcomes that can better be modelled, I think, using a multivariate approach. And there are clear applications for injury schemes as well, sort of thinking about injured worker outcomes and pathways, and as well as sort of commercial sector applications as well. So my final slide here is about completing the circle. So the welfare reform tried to take best practice from injury schemes and transplant that into welfare to see what happened. So I guess there's an obvious question there now that sort of that's been done. Is there anything that injury schemes can then learn from welfare? And I think there are some natural questions there. So one is the valuation, and sort of I've talked about the valuation and sort of the things that it can provide to management on top of a balance sheet number. However, there are sort of other views that sort of come out of that as themes. And so there's the longitudinal view, and there was a good talk on just previously about the TAC and how they're starting to think more longitudinally about their customers. There's also an emphasis on measurement and making sure that when initiatives are taken and trialled, that they are measured carefully as well. And also to what extent people are using insights and data to help drive discovery and sort of information about what might be good or less useful. So that's pretty much all I had to say. So there is some further reading, so if you do want even more charts, the latest MSD valuation report that Taylor Fry has done is available there. The original Welfare Working Group link is there. I mentioned that earlier in the talk. And there's a couple of other interesting things that sort of show, I guess, sort of how this is moving in the social sector. So one is the New Zealand Productivity Commission just gave a report on New Zealand social services. And the New South Wales government now has a hub devoted to sort of social impact investing and these sort of ideas. So thank you very much, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Now we open up for questions. Before we open up for questions, we'd like to remind you to please speak to a microphone and clearly identify yourself before asking a question. Now, who would like to start us off? Over there.
Hi, Hugh. Thank you for that. My name's Rebecca from Employers Mutual in Sydney. I'm interested in a few things, but I might just ask you one and see how that goes. What else can you tell us about the annual evaluation process? I think that was part of the Level 2 framework that you talked about. And if you can't tell me about that, I'm interested in the segment definition as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, to some extent, the report's public, so there's lots that you could find out. So the question is sort of how much do I want to try and condense into 60 seconds? So the segmentation, I'll start there. So I didn't spend a lot of time on them, but sort of these are the 17 segments. So they're sort of, the key reporting categories for the customer base. The colour theme there is basically benefit type, and that came through in a whole round of analysis that benefit type is the most important thing. If you could choose one thing that tells you something about how long someone's going to stay in the benefit system. And so that's convenient because it's also very easy to target beneficiary type or benefit type for a policy or operational intervention, so that's quite convenient. Then there are subcategories in that, and that came out of a combination of sort of statistical analysis as well as operational chain sort of thinking, sort of how easy it is to operationalise different groups, what aligned with other government objectives, as well as what is useful in distinguishing between people who are likely to stay a long time and a short time. And so some of that is obvious, but you can see the less than one and more than one represents duration in those plots, so people have been on benefits continuously for more than a year or less than a year. So duration came through as very important. Similarly, youngest child age for sole parents came through as very important, and so that was a fairly natural thing to do as well. So that's the second half of your question. The broader one is sort of what we go through the valuation process, and there's lots. But I guess one of the important things is sort of making sure we're on top of what's happening in the New Zealand welfare system, so that they're doing stuff all the time, as well as sort of lots of sort of discussions and making sure that we're sort of not out of line with what the internal teams are seeing in terms of the welfare system evolving.
Thanks, Hugh.
Anthony Claudin from KPMG. Just one or two questions. One is, as a result of what you've been finding here, is there any push to try and fund part of this? Because obviously there's the investment way of making changes so that people don't stay on welfare as long, but there's also the investment way of funding it up front and putting your money into equities, etc., so that there is more money at the end of the day. And the second question is just, is there any push to extend this? So to start looking at, say, adding in pension elements or else things which are not necessarily benefits so much, but pension or medical costs, or extend this to include people who have not been in the benefit scheme now but might be in the future.
Thank you very much. I quite like how inconveniently the microphone's been placed as well, so you have to do a limbo to get there. So the first question was whether there had been consideration to funding. The Welfare Working Group, I believe, did recommend either full or partial funding, or at least that it be considered. I believe it was considered and judged to be a big number, and that was quietly scotched. But there's a more formal, I guess, penalisation than if you do fund it, and I guess that sort of reduces potential intergenerational inequality as well. So there are good reasons why you do it. There are obvious reasons why you don't as well. Like, it costs a lot of money, and typically that's not how welfare systems have been run in the past. So that's the first one. The second one was sort of application to other sectors, and the answer is yes. I mean, the New Zealand government has saw a feasibility study they had publicly listed about social housing, and I think the New Zealand government are exploring other things as well. There are applications to Australian government and state governments, I think, as well, in terms of sectors. And certainly, if nothing else, people are interested in how it's all playing out.
I'm conscious of time and people are probably thinking about lunch. My name's John Wren. I'm from ACC Research. One of the things implicit when I look at some of this, and it's been at my head floating around on and off for a number of years because I'm involved with it, is issue of benefit transfer. And one of the issues for, given this is a compensation scheme thing, is within New Zealand there's the perennial political question of how many people are getting kicked off ACC onto an MSD benefit. And by the way, the answer is very small. we're redoing that work, and we'll have the results, and I know MSCD will publish them early next year. But I was a bit curious, given this is a compensation scheme, I just wondered if you've got a comment on it. And I actually got a question for the audience. Given the different nature of the schemes, and particularly around the entitlement benefits, I'm curious to know, has any Australian work been done about benefit transfers from compensation schemes in Australia onto Australian health benefits, for example? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. It's of great merit. Transfers from the ACC are not completely visible to the benefit system, and I guess that's why it's a slightly difficult problem. I'm not sure I've got a lot that I can sensibly comment on that, besides saying that it's an important issue, and one of the risks of sort of building these things sort of independently of each other is then you do have to worry about exactly these sorts of issues that you're sort of creating sort of cross subsidies or the opposite when you don't intend to. Welcome comments from other people too.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much, Hugh, for this very fascinating work that we've seen today. Now, please join us in thanking Hugh. Here is a bottle of wine for you.